Good afternoon, and welcome to Who's in the Kitchen. I'm Philothea Beeson, and you're listening to WDRT 91.9 FM Community Radio in Viroqua, Wisconsin, coming from the Driftless area. And you can also tune in to streaming live on the internet at WDRT.org, where you can also listen to previous shows, as we have a number of podcasts on our archives. And this is a cooking show of just about everything, home cooks, restaurants and businesses in town, and everybody who has something to do with food, the schools, hospitals, and people who are into nutrition. It's a wide-ranging show, and that inspired me to move on to a farming show, which we put on every the last Saturday of every month at noon. It's a farming show called Digging Deep, where we talk to farmers and people interested in production of food in the area. So thank you so much for tuning in. And today my guest has founded a bakery here in Viroqua. I've been trying to get him on my show for a couple of years, and now here he is. He has Rhythm Bakery right here on Main Street, and his name is Mason.
Mm-hmm. Mason Roselle, formerly Mason Pertell, but me and Laurel in my bakery.
You combined your names.
We combined our names, yeah. She was Laurelyn Rosenberger, and I was Mason Pertell. And we just did not know how to solve that impossible problem of who takes what name and how many hyphens do we stick in the middle of our name. So we went for Roselle. But
good.
I still say Pertell usually, because that was just some months ago.
Well, I'm glad I asked you, because that's cute. I think that's kind of what Wilding Ways, Frank Wilding Way.
Oh, is that? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They kind of joined their name. When did you start this bakery in Viroqua?
Yeah, we didn't quite start it. We took it over from, it was formerly Bard Bread, run by Matt Kronschnabel and Natalie Hinahara. And they started that. That was mostly Matt's passion project. And I don't know when he started it, maybe in 2018, 19 or something. And he was doing a bread CS, or a bread, or community supported bread CSB, I guess, like a CSA, but for baked goods.
So kind of subscribing, promising that you're going to order every week or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which was a really cool model. And they were doing that, I think, kind of as a home baker, and then graduated to like just outside of the home baker, and then graduated to partnering when Amy Petrozzini was renovating that big building on Main Street, formerly Dave's Pizza. They collaborated and kind of made the space, you know, the dual function gelato shop bakery. And they were running that for a while, and Laurel and I were working there for a bit, so we learned a lot from them, and then just didn't work out for them with the bakery, so they were needing to move on, and we were kind of, Laurel and I were hoping to maybe open a restaurant someday. We were trying in Madison for some years. That's a whole kind of side story, too, and we were kind of primed to take it over, I guess.
Right, so were you living in Viroqua, or did you come here to do it?
No, yeah, we had moved here. I guess during the pandemic, we were kind of like a lot of people looking to maybe like get out of the city, not just to escape like, I don't know, the city, but whatever. We were just looking for a land and a cool community, and that is here. And so we knew Matt and Natalie from Madison, from Slow Food and FH King, which are both food and farming oriented student orgs.
So you and Matt and Natalie knew each other in Madison.
Yeah.
And they worked for... What were you saying the business was?
Oh, we both were part of... Well, Matt and I met in maybe 2016 or so in Slow Food UW, which is a student org. The motto is good, clean, fair food for all. And that's a thing that started in Italy with a bunch of grown-ups. And then it... I think actually at a protesting the first McDonald's opening in Italy some time ago. I used to know all these dates because I used to have to tell the whole audience all the time when Slow Food started. But anyway, we were in it in UW-Madison as a student org, and we were in family dinner night, which was Monday nights. We'd serve 120 people, a $5 meal, three courses, and we'd source it all from like the farmer's market and the Willie Street Co-op mostly. And it was always a diff. We usually had a guest chef every week, so it was a local area chef, and they would help us cook. I remember like shakshuka or these different recipes that we'd never heard of, and we're like 18, 19, 20-year-olds. That was a really cool thing. I could go on forever about Slow Food. It's a good spot in my heart, but Matt met there.
Yeah, and that sounds like a really good foundation, good, clean, fair food.
For all.
For all. Mm-hmm. Right, and $5 for a meal? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so we were all volunteers, and it was just something we did in our free time, but it was, we were all good friends there, so you kind of didn't feel like you were volunteering so many precious hours.
So then Matt and Natalie moved out here, and they started the bakery.
Yeah.
Which was called Bard Bakery.
Yeah, Bard Bread and Pastries.
Bard Bread, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I know I bought from them, and they sold at Farmer's Market.
Yeah,
yeah, it was
Matt's
really great bread.
Baker.
And we're going to get into this, but I just feel like, you know, even if you charge a lot for your bread, it's just one loaf at a time. And when you think about the what's invested in, I know that that Matt had bought a really expensive oven, and I was wondering if you got to use the oven.
Yeah, and that's our oven now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always nervous about it because it's definitely more expensive than any car I've ever owned, you know. And
I was just, you know, knocked my socks off when I thought this was imported from Switzerland or something.
Yeah, Italy.
And I thought, wow, this is hard just with a product that only sells for like $8 a loaf.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, and you got to try and crank them out. And
oh, boy. But it worked out for him and now for you to be sharing the space in Magpie.
Yeah, which has been really cool.
Yeah, that's cool, I think, to have two operations going on sharing the same space.
Yeah.
Because rent is probably one of the big expenses.
Yeah.
And the other expenses, your employees.
Yeah, labor is the big one that gets everyone. So right now we don't have any employees. Right now it's mostly just me because Laurelyn's been on like maternity leave. She's been getting back in the kitchen lately, which I'm excited about because she's the more exciting of the two of us. I think I'm kind of the keep the bread coming out, but I think the town will be happy when she's making her fun things. So.
Well, are you making more bread than you were? It seems like there's more on the shelves when I go in. More than, you know, last year it seemed like.
Yeah, it's been creeping up a lot. I think my capacity has been increasing. I'm very, like, not defensive, but I don't know, kind of reserved or patient with the scaling of it because I'm just nervous about growing too big and suffering quality or having to hire and not being a good boss or something. So I've been kind of pacing it slowly. Sometimes it feels wise. Sometimes it feels just fearful or something, but there's been more bread. Yeah, I've been getting, my capacity's been growing, and there's been more bread out on the shelf.
Well, it seems like, you know, one of your main outlets is the food co-op town,
yeah.
And a lot of times, I mean, it's sold out. The day you bring it, it's sold out,
yeah.
And people would know when it's going to be delivered. And I thought, well, that's a good sign.
Yeah, that always feels really good. It feels
validating. And is really excellent bread, and we're so glad so many years people have tried to have a bakery here with really good sort of European style baked goods, and most people have not been able to make a go of it. And so I'd like to, you know, talk about the whole baking enterprise and how you are doing. And
I'm caffeinated, so I don't know, I could go off the rails.
You're caffeinated?
A bit. Yeah.
We were charging up over at the coffee shop across the street. So you took over, and had you been baking and stuff? How did you do that?
I was working at Origin Breads, actually at a very opportune time to learn about a bakery, because they're in Madison. They're still there. Kirk Smock is the owner.
Okay.
Making very similar. If you would go buy a loaf, maybe it's almost interchangeable with our bread.
Same recipe.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, a sourdough bread. It's kind of the written recipe isn't so important as the baker's intuition or whatever. I think that goes a long way because the recipe, like my recipe is very fuzzy because the flour is always kind of changing with the local grains. So I intentionally don't have it very precise so that I can always be on my toes and kind of adjusting daily.
Oh, okay.
So that's one of those things where there is a recipe, but if you just try to hand somebody a written recipe, chances are it's not going to turn out. You kind of have to learn.
Hey, I know about that. I had a no-knead bread recipe that I shared with a lot of people, and everybody's bread tasted different, was the same recipe. But there's just, there's so much intuition.
Which is what keeps me coming back. Yeah.
Timing and location and, you know, what kind of an oven you have and how did you put the right moisture in. And, you know, they never...
It never ends, which has, like, crafted my philosophy of it, which is some kind of, like, humility thing where it's just there's no, you might think you know the 4 or 10 or 15 factors that are going into it, but you don't know the thousand that are going to add up to, you know. So there's a little bit of, like, I don't know, bowing to it, I think.
Yeah, we'll get into that a little bit more.
Yeah.
We'll just kind of follow up on the history.
Yeah, so I was working at Origin Breads, and when I started there, maybe 2018, I had just come out of Underground Butcher in Madison, which was a cool environment, lots of creative energy and fun stuff happening there. And we were doing whole animal butchery, and then we were getting this bread delivery from this guy every week or every day or something. And I was just really taken with the aesthetic of his bread, and it was great stuff. And so I asked for a job there, and he was working. It was him, one employee, Jenny, and myself in a tiny area of a shared space in a commercial kitchen, Christine's kitchen, and there was a bunch of food carts in there. It was a fun environment, but it was pretty chaotic, and you know, the food carts at lunchtime were all scrambling to leave, and they're coming back with huge piles of dishes, and we're all sharing the spot.
Yeah.
So I got to witness, I guess is the point, a budding bakery, and Kirk figuring it out, and you know, from the ground up or whatever, which was
but
helpful.
you got the courage to think, I can do this.
Yeah, almost, not so much. I think the chance fell in our laps, and we had maybe wanted to try to have a restaurant. Well, originally it was hand-pulled noodles, because I have a whole history with that, and I had gone to China and learned these noodles, and then we wanted to open that, and then we had a pop-up restaurant that was going really well in Madison, and then COVID shut it down, and we were really thankful we didn't have any leases or anything at this time, because it was just a pop-up. And then we moved here kind of to put that dream on hold, and then the bakery kind of fell in our laps, or the opportunity to take a risk on the bakery fell in our laps. So I didn't actually have a ton of confidence. Laurelyn is more the one who pushes us to take on new challenges and things.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Well, I'm interested in the noodles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a whole story.
We could certainly use a fresh noodle shop here, and I'm sure people would love that.
Yeah, we've been meaning to do at least pop-up events or whatever.
That would be kind of fun.
Yeah.
I loved being in Europe, where you go into shops and the person behind the counter was the one who made the noodles,
mm-hmm.
or they made the pastry,
yeah,
or they made the bread.
That's the
idea.
I
love that model. I feel like Viroqua is a town where that's happening,
mm-hmm.
where you can really know mm-hmm. the shopkeepers and the restaurateurs, and they're the ones making the food and designing the menu. It's not coming from a...
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, it really is.
That attracted me to the noodle thing was, you know, they're hand-pulled to order. You have a lump of dough sitting in front of you, and this person says, I want a bowl of noodles, and you kind of quick magic show it into fresh noodles for them, and that really caught my attention.
I've seen some videos of this. I mean, noodles are magic.
Yeah.
So many ways of forming them.
Mm-hmm.
And then, well, you use machines, but you also do it just like by hand, right?
Yeah, in this case, it was it's actually the predecessor of ramen. So it's a Chinese word, la mian, which means, I think, pulled dough or something. And it's a ethnic group from the west of China that makes them. And I had gone to the east of China, into a big city, and as like a 20-year-old, just kind of, I don't know, adventuring and looking for these noodles because I had seen them online and couldn't find any reliable recipes. And these ones are made by hand, where they you just take a lump of dough that looks like a remote control or something out of that shape and length, and you pull it out with your arms to much wider, and so it gets much thinner, and then you fold it in half and flour it so it doesn't stick, and keep stretching it out and folding it in half, and it's getting thinner each time. And if as you're folding it over, it's hard to just you have
so
to see it.
So you're not cutting them.
You never cut it until
you're
the end.
Pulling.
You rip the end off, and then
they're getting thinner because you're pulling them,
yeah,
and folding, pulling and folding.
Yeah. So it's essentially one super long noodle, but it's kind of folded up in your hand.
And are you then making the gluten by all that pulling?
Yeah,
is that what you're
doing? So this is one of the, I think this, the exploration of the noodles helped to form some of my philosophy about bread, which is that no one has a clue, and everyone tries to have a clue, I think, was something along those lines. But I had seen a video, actually, on the Kung Fu Panda special features, if you'll believe it, like when I was a kid. And I just remembered it one day when I was in college, and I looked up the noodles, and it looks like magic when you see it happen. And I was looking up recipes and how to make it. And you'd see one that said to form the gluten or to align the gluten, blah, blah, blah. And they'd use scientific language, and it would say very confidently, you need to do this. And then the next article would say the exact opposite, but very confidently. And I was seeing this all over the place, and I could, no one could, there wasn't really recipes for it at that time. This wasn't that long ago, 2015 or something. And So I don't know. I was just like, was in a point in my life where I wanted an adventure. So I went to China kind of with a silly idea of like finding some master or something, which was pretty, you know, it was just a whatever, silly, like small town Wisconsin idea. But I found a 19-year-old when I was 20 at the time. He was 19 and he was the family noodle shop teacher and he taught me.
Wow. Yeah. So what kind of flour are they using for those noodles?
Over there, I don't remember. I think, well, so when we ended up making them here, it took a lot of trial and error to find flour that would work. And that's when we found Meadowlark Organics for the first time because their spelt flour was the first flour that worked for the noodles.
Spelt flour. Now, where's Meadowlark?
So they're in Ridgeway, Wisconsin. And they are incredible. And there's a lot I could say about them. You should definitely check out their website or look them up and stuff because they are doing a lot of cool things.
Is Ridgeway near Dodgeville?
It is, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they, so Hallie and John, they have a couple little kids, but they took over an organic farm that was formerly Bickford Organics, I think, Paul Bickford. That was organic cattle and dairy farm, I believe. And they took it over and turned it into grain. They've been growing their farm a bit. And then they took over Lonesome Stone Milling, which was in Lone Rock. And they, so they have the mill from there, and then they're trying to get a couple more mills up and running. But they've been on a really cool, energized, passionate project of reinvigorating the local grain chain, grain economy.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Yeah. And it's so different to be able to get fresh milled flour, isn't it?
On their bags, it says something like, I think it says flour is fresh produce or something like that. Just trying to put it in our minds that it's not just a shelf-stable dust that is flavorless and nutritionless. It's a fresh product, yeah. And they're on a cool mission of, you know, if there's no mill around, doesn't matter how many grain farmers there are, grain can't really go anywhere for humans, except for distilling, I think, brewing. But with the mill, that unlocks the key for small farmers to be able to grow good grain. And
okay, so is there a mill in Lone Rock?
I think that they moved the mill itself to their farm and mill operation in Ridgeway.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have two. There's a, I don't know if it's a brand or a type of mill called the New American Stone Mill, which their original mill is a stone mill as well, which is a big, it's an important factor. And they acquired two New American Stone Mills that they're in the process of getting up and running. So they'll be even more.
So why is it important to have stone ground flour?
That's another great question that they have a lot of information about, and I have a little bit of information about. I know that the way, so it's the old technique of doing it, and it's kind of a tried and true thing through the millennia. And the way that it breaks the grain, I don't know if it is more of a crushing action or more of, or less of a crushing action. I should know, but it has a different action than whatever the modern like roller mills and cut mills are, or whatever they're called. And something about it preserves the integrity of the grain better and preserves the nutritional value in the grain. And then they also, they don't sift, they don't, their flour isn't white, it's more tan, I would say. So there's a lot, a lot more going on in their flour.
Well, I guess they could sift it or not sift it.
Yeah, well, they have, so they have two varieties. Well, they have a lot of different varieties of flour, but for each type of grain, they have bolted, which means sifted, and whole wheat. And the whole wheat, I think, is, it's either a whole wheat or it's like 95% whole wheat. It's mostly all there. It's very brown, very, you know, flavorful and nutritional. And then the sifted one is, I don't know what percentage is, but it's still tan. It's not quite white, you know.
So it would still have the kernel. It would still be in there, but it would be ground.
Mm-hmm.
And then it would, if it wasn't sifted, would it have more of the chaff? Or
it has more of the bran. I should know the anatomy
the
better.
The bran,
you know,
mm-hmm.
One of those things, I researched this stuff a lot in the past, and then it kind of just, the details fall away and the gestalt is left or
well,
something.
Well, it's an art and a science and just tradition.
Yeah.
I'm sure a lot of it is just tradition handed down and experience like you're getting. I mean, I'm sure you're still thinking, I'm still learning, I'm still...
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And then you talk to other people, and then you say, well, some of this information is even contradictory.
Oh, yeah.
And different theories and so forth, but...
Yeah.
You kind of set aside the noodles for a while, but I bet some people would be interested in having.
Yeah, we will bring those back someday. I'm smiling because I'm
always... That would be a great thing to do for the folk school as a class.
Oh, yeah.
People
yeah.
would love to do that. And teachers get paid
to
do that. And then you can just give a class and see if people are interested.
Yeah,
that'd
I
be
think
one way.
Would be.
So now I can see that noodles actually, I mean, noodles and bread start from dough, right?
Yeah.
So I'm talking with Mason Rozelle.
Yes.
From Rhythm Bakery here in Viroqua, which he's been operating for about 2 years. And having a great success, I would say. It's a wonderful local bakery making sourdough whole grain bread.
Mm-hmm.
So right here on Main Street in Viroqua, right in the back of Magpie, which is a gelato store in Viroqua, which I think is just amazing that we have a gelato store in Viroqua. Come to Viroqua, everybody. It's a great town. So you're listening to WDRT, Community Radio, coming from Viroqua, Wisconsin, and 91.9 FM, and streaming live on the internet at WDRT.org, where you can listen to this show and previous shows, many, many previous shows from Who's in the Kitchen, and also our Farming Shore show, Digging Deep. And we always air on Saturdays at noon, coming from the Driftless area. So I'm talking with Mason about his bread business, and kind of fell into it a little bit through a friend who was also a baker, and ended up being right here in Viroqua, coming from Madison, and starting out with just like two recipes or three recipes.
Yeah.
Three kinds of bread.
Oh, boy. I mean, it fluctuates, you know. It's one, I would say, master recipe or something of the process and the general outline, and then we've tried different grains and different mix-ins and things like that as far as the bread. And then there's the whole, like, pastry side, which Laurelyn is more the boss of that because she's the creative engine. And
so are you making some pastry?
There's a little, right now we're doing some R&D and stuff. Laurelyn, you know, has done a lot, and she has a lot of experience back in Madison and then a little bit here at our bakery, and then with the baby, she took, you know, a year-ish, more or less, off, and she's, you know, rebuilding the confidence and the repertoire and stuff. But
you do make crackers.
Yeah, I haven't made them in a little bit just because I've been trying to prioritize family, but we'll have more crackers coming out because I know everyone likes those, and yeah, they're tasty, and they're a good way to use they're the excess sourdough starter is most of that cracker.
It's a sourdough cracker.
Yeah, it's a sourdough cracker. I mean, it's not leavened with sourdough. It's just in there for flavor and whatnot, but yeah, and I guess it's extra nutritional because that excess starter has been fermenting an extra couple of days in the fridge or something, so it's you know, the nutrition is unlocked or whatever the heck happens with sourdough and grain, which is a mystery.
Well, for people for people who've never made bread, but also for people who are interested in making bread, why don't you go through the process that you guys go through to make your bread? And I'm not as familiar with sourdough. Mm-hmm. I always let the sourdough get black in the refrigerator and forget to renew it. So, but anyway.
Well, I found out, oddly enough, after we took a month off, we went down to New Orleans, and I had a few, just to experiment with how resilient a sourdough starter is to being away from it. I had a friend watching some sourdough starter, but I also tried leaving some just in the fridge. I also tried drying some out just on the table or whatever, to see how to best, when I came back from the trip, which one would be the best. Just a little, not very precise science. But the one I left in the fridge, and it got all black on top, and then I poured that off and just used a bit from the bottom to start feeding again. That one actually turned out, it was just fine. Yeah,
it was still alive.
That was a month, you know.
Yeah, don't give up.
So I guess, you know, it's a process that's always cycling and kind of folding on itself, so it's kind of hard to find the, you know, chicken and egg, like the beginning point, I guess. But you could just talk about, there's the starter that I, you know, come into on, say, on Tuesday, and I have a full bin of starter that I've fed, and it's active and bubbly and fragrant.
A bin of starter.
Yeah.
I mean, you're
so,
showing with your arms.
Yeah,
this is not a cup.
Yeah, I guess over the weekend. So we'll say over the weekend I have a cup or so of starter, 2 cups or something, in the fridge, and that's the like seed. And then on Monday I'll come in and use that cup or so to turn into, I don't know, maybe 30 pounds or something of starter. I don't know, 20 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
A bin a bus bin of starter.
That's pretty magical.
Yeah.
What is happening there? So you're adding flour and water?
Yeah. So short answer, I don't know. Long answer, it's flour and water in equal parts. which we use the whole wheat flour from Meadowlark Organics, their bread flour. And so it's equal parts flour and water. And then you can get very precise with how much seed starter, and it would probably be helpful for me to be more precise with it. But I, as I said, part of my philosophy is kind of like playing with the unknown aspect of it, and trying to be a little bit not too precise, so I don't get too secure in the precision, and then it throws me for a loop and I get surprised. So I use a kind of imprecise amount of seed starter, but it's a very small percentage. You could even use just like a teaspoon to make that huge bin. If you left it out overnight in a warm room, to make that full bus bin of starter, you could use, you know, a little teaspoon or whatever.
Wow.
If it's warm enough, and the mixing water, the temperature you use to make the starter is important. I could use cold water out of the faucet and it might not be ready for me tomorrow, and I can use all the way hot water and it might kick off the enzymatic activity in the flour too fast. That would, you know, make the whole trajectory happen way too fast, and it would be long gone before I get there tomorrow.
Oh.
So
the temperature would be kind of like warm to the touch?
Warm. Yeah, it depends on the season too. And right now, the kitchen stays kind of cool. It's usually like in the low 60s in there.
Mm-hmm.
That's another thing. I don't use a thermometer to temp my bread because I don't want to get too reliant on the numbers and like, I don't know, get surprised. But very warm to the touch, I would say, is the temperature that I use. And then I put it in the fridge at 43 overnight. And then the next morning I have a full bus tub of hopefully
so
very
active. So
it'll
keep on rising in the fridge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so then you have to mix warm. If you're putting it in the fridge, you want to put a warm bin in the fridge. But then, you know, once it cools down to its fridge temp, it's going to be more consistent. But it's kind of whatever rhythm you find that works for your lifestyle or bakery or whatever. It's pretty...
Right.
Yeah.
So if you let it... What are you calling it? To breed or ferment too fast...
Yeah.
It'll kind of play out.
Yeah.
So you kind of want to moderate the temperature.
Yeah, there's a certain window you want to hit, mm-hmm. and if it goes mm-hmm. too fast, you'll just have very sour... It gets more and more acidic over time, and then the acidity is good to a point, but at a certain point, it degrades the gluten structure. Like, gluten as a protein gets weaker at a certain pH, a certain acidity.
Oh, I see.
I think it's a similar process to why cheese curdles when it's... Or milk curdles when acid is introduced.
Mm-hmm.
So if the starter gets too acidic and then you add it to your bread, it shreds. I mean, the dough is usually consistent, and I've gotten the flow of it good enough that I don't have to think too much about it. But in the past, I've had a lot of failed batches where you're trying to shape the dough and it's just shredding and ripping, and you know that it's overproofed.
Okay.
In that case.
Okay.
But all of it is so feel-based, it's hard to
describe. If you really want to learn how to bake, you really need to... put your hands in and somebody tells you this is what it's supposed to feel like and look like and smell like.
Yeah. So ideally the next morning, you know, I come in and there's that bin of starter and it's fragrant, and but not too stinky and pungent, but just sort of aromatic, and there's a certain kind of smell and feel that I'm hoping for. And it's never at that perfect spot, but it's always right near it, you know, because you never can kind of get it just right. And then I'll mix our dough, which at the bakery I worked in Madison, we hand mixed it all, which was a huge laborious task. I remember when I first started, I was like knocked out for a week or two just from, you know,
hand kneading.
Yeah, they're big batches. But we have a mixer, so we mix. It's water, starter, flour, salt. Is it? We have two main doughs. We make the one for the Nausicaa loaf is all whole wheat and a little bit of spelt, and the other is the Nimbus, which is light and fluffy like a cloud. That's why it's the Nimbus. So that's the sifted flour one. So it's lighter in color and texture. Mm-hmm. And so it's just, the flour, which is usually... Which you want the dough to be proofing for most of its bulk ferment, which is the first stage of fermentation in the high 70s, 75 to 80 or so. So like I come into the bakery, if it's 60-something in there, the flour is at 60-something. The metal bowl of the mixer is at 60-something. The starter is coming out of the fridge at 40-something. And I want to make water that's going to try and bring that whole mass up to 75 to 80.
Oh, okay.
So mm-hmm. there's a lot of, that's where the intuition bit comes in. It's kind of, it's too much to compute precisely, I think. You kind of have to know your room, know your starter, know your flour.
But right. The temperature of the bowl, the temperature of the flour. Yeah.
But I mean, it's easy enough to mm-hmm. start it, I think, even just at a mm-hmm. home scale. You just have to be, I think, patient with... The internet will say, make sure you use the temperature water, and it might not work out that way first time, but, you know, it's practicing and figuring
so
it out.
So you start with one or two cups of sourdough starter.
Yeah, so in like
our... And then overnight, yeah. It becomes a tub, a very big tub.
And then
you add flour and water and salt.
Yeah, so that one tub, if I mix all that into bread, it would yield maybe sometimes a dozen tubs or something of dough that are all proofing on the table at once. So I'm mixing these batches that are maybe three or four tubs in size. And there's a whole conversation about the autolyse. People might be familiar with that term, which is you're supposed to mix the starter and the water and the flour and no salt and mix it together and let it sit for 5 minutes or 10 minutes or a half hour or an hour. And different bakers online have a lot of confidence about what that yields. And I've tried it, and I've tried not doing it, and I might be... It's not very scientific, my method of inquiry, but I haven't noticed it actually really doing anything. So you can autolyse before you add the salt. Otherwise, we just add all the ingredients together in the beginning.
I think the salt kind of holds back the rising.
It slows the fermentation.
Okay.
So the idea of the autolyse is that before the salt is introduced, you'd have this warm water and this active starter and the flour, which is like food for the starter, and it would just all start kicking off. The enzymes would start acting before you introduce the salt to slow it down.
Is there any sugar involved? Or is sugar in the
grain? Yeah, but there's no sugar.
No added sugar.
No.
Okay.
And we don't, we don't use any sugar in our, that's kind of our conversation, I guess, but our sourcing is kind of a whole thing.
And salt? Is there any particular salt you
we
use?
We just use, we use Jacobson sea salt. They're in, is it Seattle or Portland or somewhere way out west?
Mm-hmm.
And they're a smallish company, and I don't know. We researched them in the beginning, and they seem like they're doing cool, kind of less mechanized techniques, or trying to do sea salt the right way, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So our sourcing is all local, except that salt, which is, I mean, I don't know, it's coming from the West Coast, but the local salt is usually mined, and I don't know a ton about mining, but it doesn't sound particularly sustainable. I don't really know. So Jacobson sea salt is what we use, and it's just coarse sea salt. It's tasty stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There's also stuff online about if you use coarse salt versus fine salt, and some recipes will say you need to use fine salt. We've been using coarse salt, and it's been working just fine for us. Mm-hmm. That just happens to be what that salt is coarse. But
so now you've kneaded it, and you're great big.
So we've mixed it, and now we're going to bake it in 24 hours or so. So in the meantime, it's going to ferment, the bulk ferment, which is it's in those bus tubs, like a hotel bus tub or whatever. For maybe in the summer, maybe 2 hours, in the winter, maybe 4 or 5 hours, depending on the temperature of the room. It's got to get to a certain poofiness that the baker judges at a certain point when it's time to, But so in the meantime, we usually try to get 3 stretch and folds on it. And what that entails is so they mixed it, and then about an hour later or so, or half hour later, depending on the temperature of the room, we'll, kind of wet my hands and stretch the dough out, as far as you can without ripping it, and fold it over on itself, and do that from a few different angles, and kind of you're strengthening the gluten in that process, and kind of getting the temperature more consistent. Because as it's sitting in that bin, if the room is hot or cold, the outside of the dough might be taking on the room temperature, and the inside is staying the same. So it's moving temperature around and strengthening the gluten.
So it's really been touched by human hands.
Oh yeah, a whole bunch. And then we do that 2 to 3 times over the course of a few hours. And in that meantime, I'm baking today's bread and delivering or doing other bakery tasks or whatever. And when it's time to shape, then I will dump a bin out on the table, dust it with flour so it doesn't stick too much, and I'm weighing with a little scale each loaf individually. And then from there, you're rounding them into the pre-shape, which is just rounding into a circle. It's an impossible to describe motion, I guess, but you're just using both of your hands to turn the amorphous blob of dough into like a tight sphere-ish, lining them all up on the table, and I let those sit for either no time at all. If it's hot and the dough's, my previous boss said, the dough waits for no man. so if the dough is going fast and it's hot in there, you better move and you better not let it sit at all. But if it's a cooler day and it's not moving so fast and you have other tasks to do, you can let these pre-shaped balls all sit on the table under moist towels for, an hour or something if you need.
So it is important to cover them.
If you're going to let them sit,
towel.
Yeah, because especially in the winter, if it's dry,
kind of
air,
a little
they'll get a crusty edge to them, yeah. If I'm just going right into it, I won't cover them, but if I'm going to let them sit for a bit, I'll cover them. And then you're going to do the final shape. So then it's either sandwich loaves, which are getting shaped in a certain way with a flurry of hand motions and then put in sandwich tins to bake or to ferment overnight, or batards or boules are two other common shapes. The boules are the circular ones. Batards are ovals.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. So those, yeah. And then once, you know, then so it's sitting on the table like that, shape it like in those, one of those ways. And then if it's a boule or batard, it's going to go upside down in a banneton, like a basket. Like you've seen the cane ones probably. We have wood pulp ones.
Are those lined or they just go straight in?
They just go straight in, okay. Yeah. They're from Germany and they're called Bratformen, I think. But yeah, they're like wood pulp. And they're absorb. I think part of it is that they're absorbent, they absorb moisture. So the wood cane ones are like dry, you know, cane.
Oh, okay.
Because the dough sometimes, as it's fermenting, will like leak a bit of moisture. And it's nice to have that kind of wicked away into the bannetons. And then those go in the fridge overnight at 40, well, between, I would say, usually 38 to 45 degrees, depending on, again, if they're really proofed. And it's a judgment call every night as I, like, am leaving the bakery. It's like, what temperature should I put the fridge at? Because if they're really proofing fast, I should put it low. If they're proofing slow, I should put it high. But you inevitably don't nail it on the head every time, and there's a little bit of second guessing there. But they'll sit overnight in the fridge, and in the morning, the first thing to do is to bake them off. So, and I guess I can explain that a bit.
Do you have moisture in the oven?
Yeah, so we have steam injected oven. That's part of the oven being really fancy, is it has steam injection, which is nice. Otherwise, you can, like in a home oven, you can, you know, bake right in a Dutch oven is a method so that it steams itself. Otherwise, you can like splash a cup of water in there or something. But our oven has a button I can push, and I've already set the time, and it goes for 12 seconds or something, and mm-hmm. put steam in there.
So that makes a nice crust.
Yeah, it helps it to rise, because partially if the oven is too dry, a crust will form too quickly, and then the dough won't be able to rise because it's trying to push through a strong exterior crunchy crust too early. So the moisture helps keep it pliable while it rises.
Okay.
And then it adds to the color near the end, having this moisture mm-hmm. around. Well, you eventually let the moisture out of the oven after the first three quarters or so of the bake.
So how do you know when your bread is done? I bet you're not perfectly timing it. You're probably not using a thermometer.
Yeah, I've been using a thermometer on some of the like the sandwich loaf is pretty big, and I want to always make sure that the inside is cooked through. But it like the look test, you know, never fails. So the temperature that we bake at is 480, and so at that temperature with the dough that I'm putting in, you kind of know your own flow. Then by the time the top is starting to get those little black areas to it, the inside is good.
And you can smell it. You can just smell it.
Oh, yeah, it smells great.
Right.
Yeah. So we like that little bit of...
Do you have a temperature that you consider done?
Yeah, I usually shoot for over 180.
180.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I usually... With the sandwich ones, I like to see 190 just so I know that I'm not hitting just a...
I know when I first started baking bread, I mean, I didn't even know, and sometimes it wasn't done on the inside.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But we go for 190, and it's always done on the inside.
Okay. So there isn't any fat involved in your bread.
No, yeah.
No.
We do make brioche as well. Again, that's in Laurelyn's wheelhouse. She likes working with, you know, the butter mm-hmm. and eggs and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that, so that has fat, that has butter
right.
and stuff. But our main loaves, the Nimbus, you know, or whatever, Nausicaa.
Do you even oil the pans? Or when you put your bread in a pan, is it...
For the sandwich loaves, they're mm-hmm. going in a pan with... There's sunflower oil in the four corners. So that's local organic sunflower oil.
And it's
a dot of it. But
yeah, isn't it great? We got our own oil out here, too.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's one thing our mission has been is in our food journey has been to discover for ourselves, but then also to, I don't know, spread the word that we Wisconsin makes things. You don't have to get everything from elsewhere. So using sunflower oil has been Driftless Organics does, theirs is so beautiful and gold and fragrant, and then...
Supporting another local business.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's great. Well, then I noticed that you with your, which I can't remember which one, the sandwich loaf.
Yeah.
You can slice that for people. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we have a slicer.
I really like that because it is hard slicing a loaf of bread that's really got a tough crust.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't mind slicing it. It's, I have fun riding the slicer for an hour or so a day and getting all those loaves sliced. It's fun. Like at home, we like the kind of the breaking bread, you know, thing.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a little bit of us that's always trying to, like, you know, push that into the world just to encourage that kind of different method of eating bread. Mm. But of course, the sliced loaf is super nice and convenient. And
well, yeah, you have a little more control. You don't want your bread too thick for a sandwich or something. So, so yeah, it's nice, and I'm definitely a fan. Boy, I really enjoy the bread, and it makes great toast. Absolutely great toast.
Yeah, yeah, it does. You can freeze it too, which is you can have it sliced and then frozen, and just pull out a slice and toast it.
Well, that's what I do because the loaf is big, and just for me, or even with me and my son. We just wouldn't even go through a loaf in a week.
Yeah.
So I usually, you know, put half of it in the freezer.
Yeah. We go through a few a week in our house.
You do.
Yeah, cruise through it, yeah.
Well, I love bread, but I'm sort of trying to get back on the carbs. But when you've got a whole grain bread like that, you feel like, well, you're getting a lot of value, a lot of protein.
Yeah, and that's part of Meadowlark's, I mean, you know, by extension, our mission, Meadowlark's mission is saying, you know, flour isn't a nutritionless, flavorless, white powder that just sort of makes bread or something. It's a food with nutritional value to it. Yeah, you can't just eat bread all day long, but this type of bread I think is really it's something that's it's not just a filler.
So now I'm thinking about your schedule. It just sounds like you're in, you're out. You're in, you're out.
Yeah,
it's a good thing to be living in town.
Well, we don't live
in
town. We live 10 minutes out. I mean, there's a lot of tasks in the bakery, and there's the delivering and baking and stuff, you know. So while the dough has these kind of waiting periods, my hands are always busy, especially if we're doing when we're doing other things, like we do pizza night sometimes, that'll come back sometime, and other things. There's a lot of tasks going on, but now with our family, you know, Magpie is a great space because Laurelin and Simma often are hanging out up front, and if I have some in-between time, I can, you know, leave dishes for later and go hang out with the baby and stuff for a while, so... Yeah, it is. It's a cool schedule. I'm really happy doing it.
That's good. Now, do you bake 7 days a week, or do you have a pause time?
Yeah. So right now I'm in there Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and so Tuesday is mixing bread for Wednesday. Wednesday is baking and mixing bread for Thursday. Thursday, you know, into Friday, and so baking Wednesday through Saturday. So we give ourselves a, you know. I think the bakery will be doing more in the future. It's one of those things we've been getting our feet under us, trying to be sturdy about it and, I don't know, build something that'll last, I guess. So it's been
good. You find out when you have a baby that just, this takes a lot of time.
Yeah, it does.
And
it's great.
Yeah, your schedule is a little bit, but it sounds like you can work it around your family.
Yeah, it's working
out.
It's
a family business, and that's really great.
Yeah, I'm grateful for the whole thing. And the Magpie collaboration has been really nice for that. That space is just nice to have a baby hanging out in.
So when I have talked to people about when they're in the food business, part of it is marketing and transportation and storage.
Yeah.
So talk about those things.
Yeah. I mean, it's less of a thing. I think our business being so small and so local is like we don't, you know, each day I'm baking, I'm delivering, you know, by bike to the co-op and Noble Rind and Driftless and Wonder State. And, you know, it's kind of by bike or by foot. So you don't have to hire, like, a transportation or anything like that. And there's some bread that goes to La Crosse that comes when our flour gets delivered. Just today, our flour was delivered, and they're going to La Crosse afterwards. So they take bread with them to La Crosse.
Great.
For the price of a loaf or two, we just give them, you know, to munch on the way or something.
Okay.
So we've patched together a little bit of that happens out here, I guess. This community is kind of ripe with those kind of connections. So we don't have to worry too much about transportation and storage. I don't know if you're referring more to the product itself.
You know, well, yeah, I guess I'm thinking, well, I guess you're getting rid of the bread just as fast as you bake it.
Mostly,
but you are storing flour.
Yeah, we got a lot of flour.
Not grain. I guess everything's coming in as ground flour.
Yeah.
But that's susceptible to pests and things like that. You're going to have to protect it.
Yeah, I mean, the bags that it comes in are pretty robust. And
you don't freeze it? Do you just refrigerate it?
It's just out.
It's just room temperature?
Yeah, I mean, but we go through it, you know, because we get a delivery every 2 weeks.
Okay.
And we've used most of our flour when they come. You know, I always order a little bit extra than we're going to eat, not to run out. But
so they deliver the flour.
They deliver it, yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Then marketing. I mean, how did you?
We were lucky enough to take over from Bard and, you know, Matt and Natalie did a great, I mean, people loved Bard, you know, and it was great bread and well marketed. So there was already a hunger and there was a little lag in the bread between as the businesses was changing hands. So there was a lot of hunger and we didn't need to do much marketing. We used Instagram a bit, just as a, you know, we're people from our times, I guess, but we've fallen away from that, just, you know, dissatisfied.
So how far afield are you selling your bread?
Mostly just Viroqua, and then the Root Note serves it in La Crosse, and occasionally, like we have, we're going to deliver some crackers to Madison, to Pastor and Plenty. You know, Kickapoo Exchange and Gay's Mills sells the bread, but it's not going much, you know, beyond that. Or, you know, on some level, you want to, you know, you want to grow and expand, but it's also like, oh, we're, you know, we're a local business, local produce, so we're going to try to keep it as close to home, I guess, as possible.
Well, you are doing that, and it seems like, I know you sound like you're being cautious and trying to not get yourself overwhelmed or overpromise things that you can't deliver, or overpaying staff and having too much overhead so that you really can't make it selling the bread. And I'm talking with Mason Roselle, and he is right from the Viroqua area and has a bakery here in Viroqua called Rhythm Bakery. And you've probably seen his bread at the food co-op, and it's also at the Gay's Mills Kickapoo Exchange. And recently moved into their original quarters. They just did it last weekend.
Oh, wow.
And that's a big change.
Yeah.
After the flood, it's been years.
Right. We haven't even been down there to their store.
So I know that they appreciate the bread there. And then, you know, of course, there's a co-op in La Crosse if you wanted to expand to that. I mean, that would be probably the next logical... Yeah. You know, it's still in the region.
Yeah, and there's a lot of demand for good bread. It's pretty simple stuff, but I think people want just the good ingredients and the good stuff. So,
Well, what I have been worrying about too is just like, can you make a living making bread?
Yeah,
I mean,
I guess so.
Is it like a viable business plan?
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I've never been, you know. I don't concern myself too much with money as long as our bills are getting paid and stuff, and especially this last year with the baby and Laurelyn being not working as much, you know, has been tight. But I think this community is supportive of the bread pricing being what it needs to be, that we can, you know, we're supporting ourselves and stuff and figuring out, learning the whole accounting game and all the taxes and all this stuff. And as new business owners, we're always floundering with how to file our taxes and these kind of things, but it's working out.
That's the thing about starting your own business. You do have the business side of it.
Yeah, which we don't like as much, but it's part of it, so, you know, you got to do it. But, yeah, it's working. I think if you're willing to work hard and stuff, it's people want the bread. So as long as I keep showing up to work, I think it'll keep working out.
So the other expansion you could do is make some different products, and it sounds like your wife is really kind of interested in the pastry.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so what are some of the things that you've made before and that you hope to make in the future?
Oh, goodness. She's made so many things over the years. I think she has a Laurelyn, this is. She's incredibly creative with the pastries and with the ingredients and the local ingredients, because our whole motto, or our whole like thing, is we only use local ingredients. Except for our salt is coming from the West Coast. But what has she made? So many things. My birthday cake every year has been a squash Basque cake, that she makes, which is incredible. And it's
from winter squash?
Yeah, from usually squash from Circadian Organics, which is our favorite farm. Those are our friends Dylan and Skye. But I think she usually uses a honey nut or something, you know, sweeter. And then it's got, kind of stick in your teeth a little bit, sweet on the edges, but kind of custardy on the inside. And that's a really good one. But she's made all sorts of things. I'm trying to think. We used to do events in Madison where she would kind of have full creative license just to create something wild on the spot. And I remember like a spicy popcorn honey cake at one point that was really good, really came together. Yeah, I think she likes
Are these things you could just sell right through Magpie? I mean, people just coming in there for coffee, you can have...
Yeah, I mean, the ultimate
rolls,
dream is to
pastries.
Have our own cute bakery, you know, in the near future or far future. We were having a good time, you know, at Magpie. It's a good collaboration. But, of course, the dream is to have your own cute bakery, and you can kind of curate it how you want. And and I think for Laurelyn especially, as she's picturing her creations, you know, she kind of wants to be the one behind the counter selling it or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So,
will you ever make a white kind of French baguette type of sourdough?
Yeah, I mean, there's a complicated answer to that. Well, we have made baguettes in the past, and I wasn't quite happy with them being perfect, so I've been kind of like testing a bit. the process, and we're going to unveil them again sometime soon. I say a complicated answer because there's kind of that the history. I don't know the history of baguette specifically all that well, but all this bread comes from pre-yeast and pre-white flour, so all of it originally would be, you know, a bit tanner and browner, like kind of how our bread is, mm-hmm. and then it kind of got, you know, moved into the whiter, yeastier mm-hmm. modern world mm-hmm. or whatever. So our baguettes will be, I think, maybe more. More true to maybe what a baguette was before.
Mm-hmm.
So it might not be as familiar to us now, but it'll be, I think, a bit closer to like a French baguette mm-hmm. was of the past.
I was in France. This is probably about 6 years ago now, and we asked if we could go behind the bakery and see mm-hmm. where the bread was being baked.
Yeah.
And there were some guys out there, and when we came out, they put on their shirts for one thing. Mm. Oops, we don't have any shirts on. And I did a video on my camera just of the whole process. It was so fascinating because I had never seen how they made the baguettes. I mean, how they mm-hmm. shaped them, and they had this kind of stiff canvas that they... and they sort of pleat it, and they make these, you know, beds or mm-hmm. couches for the bread.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've missed the part where they got them off of the cloth and into the oven because that's kind of a trick too. Aren't rolling back and forth or something.
There's a I don't know if it has a name to it. It's a piece of wood that we use.
Oh, that's right.
That has a baguette board. I think we just call it that. You can kind of like roll the whole baguette onto, and then you put it
and you flip it over again.
Yeah, we put it. We have pieces of plywood that we flour mm-hmm. with dust or dust with flour mm-hmm. to then shimmy them off into the oven.
Right. And so then they told us always get traditionnel.
Okay.
Which they meant probably what you were talking about.
It could be.
For one thing, they wanted to make sure that we always got sourdough because
mm-hmm.
you can get white baguettes and they're just yeast.
Yeah.
But I know they meant sourdough, but then they might have also meant the flour. But I wonder even if the flour in France is different from ours.
Yeah, I think that the flour that Meadowlark is growing and milling is similar. It's the old world flour. It's the good mm-hmm. stuff. It's the more nutritional and flavorful.
So there's a chance. Yeah, and so can just regular people go to Meadowlark and buy flour?
Yeah,
you can go to their website. I mean, they have a store or something,
They have a website. They have. Uh-huh. They do. They deliver to us every 2 weeks. And there's a few people that will get delivered. Like when the flour truck came today, there was a name on a bag. Somebody got 50 pounds of flour. You don't have to get that big of quantity. Just a person in the community, and they come pick it up.
Oh, I see.
They also do grain shares. So there's different levels, like bread baker and I don't bake, or these kinds of like categories.
Oh,
and you get
cool.
a small or large box of various
flour. Kind
of
like a CSA.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like a CSA. And they have a lot. They have rye and spelt and different heirloom grains, and they have beans. We eat their beans all the time.
That's pretty interesting.
And there's flax seeds coming out of Minnesota that Meadowlark sells, and they grow oats, and they have all sorts of grains and grainish things that you can get. Yeah, go to their website, I think.
Well, where did you come up with the name Rhythm Bakery?
Short story, long answer. I think that the word just struck me as one that has a lot of, you could kind of muse on it forever, I think. And it definitely, for me, invokes some of the like yin-yang kind of, like rhythm has up, down, the rise. And there's some easy bakery analogies you could think of the rise and fall of the dough, the, you know, raw and the baked and the, you know, all these, I don't know, dough-related metaphors. And there's a kind of a yin-yang aspect to it, I think, that gets me. But it's just also a cool word, rhythm. There's no vowel except for a Y, which is like a part-time vowel. And no one knows how to spell it. And I think it just feels like a word that you could kind of think about forever, and I kind of like that. And, of course, bread is like I feel like for us, you know, it's on our table for every meal. It's kind of, it provides the rhythm that the jazz is happening over the top of, I think, of life. And it's like the bread can be an anchor that's always sort of there,
mm-hmm.
like a cup of coffee mm-hmm. or something.
Yeah, daily bread.
Yeah, exactly.
And then Nimbus, you said it was like a cloud.
Yeah.
It's lighter.
Yeah, it's a lighter, fluffier one.
That's a sandwich.
We can make it in the sandwich shape and then also the batard shape. So we call that like a table loaf or something you could picture just on your
mm-hmm.
table that you're tearing into a soup or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Nausicaa's loaf, which is
Nausicaa. Oh,
yeah.
That's right. That's the third one.
Yeah, so that one's whole wheat and spelt. So it's a bit denser, a bit more, you know, brown and flavorful. And that is just named after a character in a movie that we like, Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind. It's an 80s anime one by Miyazaki.
Well, you do sound really like an intuitive baker.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Trying to learn.
Really, and really trying to have the values of sourcing here locally and keeping it a family business and marketing locally and sharing transportation when you can. It really seems like ethically sustainable.
Yeah, we're trying to do our
best. Yeah, I was noticing, you and I have been talking about packaging and trying to find, you know, at least what we think is compostable plastic, and we're still, you know, researching all that, but packaging food is really a question, and, you know, I'm really interested in the whole plastic thing and trying to find more sustainable ways of packaging food. But I did find out that your bread goes really fast if you have it in paper.
Yeah,
you've got to get it wrapped in plastic when you get it home if it came in paper. Yeah. Are you now just all wrapping it all in plastic?
Well, the sandwich ones, which are sliced, we wrap in, I guess it's cellophane or whatever. It says biodegradable on it or whatever. But it's a more, it's a plasticier material, and that holds the moisture a bit, which especially in winter, it'll dry out quick. But, you know, at home, we have the other loaves are all in the compostable, like, paper bags
or
whatever.
Paper with a little window.
Yeah. And they last pretty... I mean, for us, we go through bread pretty fast at home. So we, you know...
you do.
It gets a little stale, you can always wake it up in the oven. Even, like, if you put it... You can just toast it, but otherwise you can wrap it in tin foil or put it in, like, a Dutch oven, even if it's, like, a rock-hard loaf, and put it in the oven for a little bit, and it'll like, moisten up and be soft.
Really?
And,
that's good to know.
It'll feel like it's fresh-baked.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I've been talking with Mason from Rhythm Bakery right here in Viroqua, and it's been really fun talking with you. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to Who's in the Kitchen. I'm Philothea Beeson. We air every Saturday at noon. Last Saturday of the month is Digging Deep, our farming show. And thank you so much for listening to our program, Who's in the Kitchen, from WDRT 91.9 FM and streaming live on the internet at wdrt.org. And we look forward to talking with you again next week.